I know a little, I've read a little bit about Fourier, and this adds a lot to what I know about it. To what extent was Fourier influential, or to what extent were his ideas directly kind of picked up by other people after him? In other words, can you draw a line between Fourier and, let's say, Goldman or Dadas or anybody? You know, I mean, was he really just kind of stuck there by himself?
He was kind of by himself. There were communes, especially in the U.S. There was one that lasted a year that actually hung itself strictly on his
ideas. The last hour?
A year. That was the longest. I mean, there were several experiments in Europe and even more so several in the U.S. that kind of made a go of it and tried it anyway. Yeah, and I can't remember who it was. He's kind of famous, like Utopian thinker in the U.S. And it lasted a year, that was it. So mostly it was just experiments, like, and you don't even really hear much mention of PBA at all.
Except for those experiments.
Yeah, yeah. Well, most people actually interested in, like, utopian communities, and starting utopian communities.
When was that?
For me?
Like, when was that?
Fourier? Mostly, well, he's, what, early 19th century, like early 1800s, and then it's like mid to late 1800s, people are starting like communes and utopias based around him. I mean, I think it appealed to a lot of people, and I think they kind of took it too far.
Well, probably not as far as Fourier. What would want to do?
I mean, I think, yeah, like it has appeal, right? I mean, I think it has appeal in the sense of that concern and the frustration that he felt. Like, he just felt so frustrated that people were just so sexually repressed. And there was not, like, I mean, there were to be public orgies that would be sanctioned in the court of love. And he was so concerned about everybody, no matter what they were into or who they were into. Like, there were no limits, there were no judgments at all. Like,
so whatever
fetish you could come up with, he desperately wanted everyone to be able to enjoy that and realize that without any sort of judgment from anyone else. So, I mean, in that sense, it's kind of neat and admirable that he was just so concerned that he thought, okay, no, the only way we're going to get that kind of world where everyone feels comfortable is we're totally going to have to map this out.
So is this kind of like the Victorian era, or like when was he, like what was
yeah.
the era? So that's pretty extreme, early Victorian era.
Yeah.
How do issues of consent fit into harmony? I mean, there's are there none?
Not really.
Okay.
Well, I mean, yeah, but they're, well, obviously not for the beautiful couple.
Right.
Like, if it's designed as a, yeah, you're the happy couple, you're at, then, yeah, that's it. Literally. Yeah. So no, that's the weird thing, right? I mean, that's the sort of extreme example of that the weird twist that in trying to give everyone everything, consent is gone, and suddenly there are really strong limitations. Yeah. Like, I mean, what? I mean, you can't consent to be alone with one person. You can't. Like, you have to participate in the court of love.
Okay.
You have to. Like, you can't just say, okay, no, I don't want to participate in a huge public orgy today. You have to join.
What about the communities that were created? The one that you said lasted for a year?
I've never really heard much in terms of detail. You just hear, because I think mostly because they're generally pretty isolated, and you just sort of hear people tried the experiment, it didn't work, people left, people got frustrated. And I think it just ended up getting more confused. Like, I think it was just generally people that were really interested in sexual freedom and sexual experimentation, kind of going off in the woods and starting a community, who then weren't all that interested in actually starting a court of love and mapping all of this stuff and figuring out the details and like, okay, so who's the beautiful couple? Like, okay, so, like, I don't want to be beautiful. So yeah, I don't think in the end they were really interested in all the details and the bureaucracy and the administration and like there's a lot of stuff going on in his communities to deal with and setting all that stuff up.
Did he talk about the bureaucracy, like how to organize like how to figure out who the beautiful people are, and like, did he address those kind of issues?
No, not that. I mean, he talked more about like the court of love and public orgies and different types of like adultery and jealousy and how to get rid of those. But I mean, essentially, it was he figured if he just set up this perfect world, then everything will work itself out.
And the sexuality of children? Did he speak?
You had to be 18, actually.
Really?
Yeah. And before 18, you couldn't do anything.
But you were like surrounded by it.
Then he applied that limitation, and for the period as late as 18. But like, and he was very like, as before 18, you have no sense of sexuality. And if you do, you shouldn't actually be practicing it. But then once you hit 18, then it's you go off the bed, so yeah, which is interesting.
Is that something he elaborated on at all, or was it just sort of...
No, not really. It's like, I mean, a lot of this stuff, yeah, isn't very elaborated at all. It's kind of like, this is how it's going to go, this is how it's best done. And it's still in that sense of, okay, I really have everyone's best interests at heart here, and this is going to be the perfect world for everyone, and everything will be great, you just have to do it just like this. Which is an extreme example, I think, of more kind of looser ideas, like say the Lacan moves, like the radical democracy here, but or like Habermas, like this idea that, you know, this like kind of there, here's a perfect democratic space, and now I'm going to tell you exactly how a perfect democratic space can be set up, and that's kind of how it's going to stay. Which I think for me, it's kind of a more extreme example.
Just seems like there's a really fascinating potential for some philosophies in how to raise your children. And with what view of sexuality, and it's unfortunate that he didn't continue down that path.
Because it's kind of an end note, you know, okay, no, everyone has to be 18 or over, but no expanding on sexuality and youth.
That's funny, because it seems like you're going to be, by the time you're 18, you're going to be really sexually oppressed and fucked
up.
By the time you get to society.
Especially when people were getting married at like 12 or 14. What do you do for those? Okay, you have been having married sex for 4 years now. The orgy can begin.
Well, yeah.
Did he ever reconcile in his writings? Because he was writing and living, I'm assuming, at the same time that several of these experimental communities were going on. Was there any sort of reconciliation in his writing between, okay, these are the experiences that we've seen in these free love communities, or these are the experiences that, you know, this community of people have gone through, and this is what they were doing wrong, or this is how, you know, was it all entirely theoretical, or did he go back to people who sort of tried to implement these communities and look to those experiments to see how they worked and what the challenges were?
I mean, as far as I can remember, yes and no. I mean, he'd make like slight reference to other communities, and but then focus on his ideal and how harmony was the ideal. And basically, they weren't doing it like he suggested.
So it was wrong, and of course it didn't work.
Yeah, and without getting into all the details of why they weren't working, just, mm-hmm. Yeah. They had some limitations, or theirs wasn't as open, or it wasn't as centered on that, you know, there are all these ideal communities that, you know, that were based on economics and culture and mutual aid and stuff, but for him, the central focus had to be sexuality. That was kind of the driving ethos of our existence, like that's what we were made up of. I mean, kind of like Wilhelm Reich in this idea that the world is made up of sexual energy, and it's a matter of tapping into that. And so for him, all the other communities that weren't centrally focused on pleasure and sexuality were missing the point, and because most of them weren't. So.
But what you said about how did he see people dealing with jealousy, like in terms of non-monogamous relationships, and also did he see sexuality as being completely removed from relationships, like emotional relationships, or like were people allowed to have emotional attachments that would look like a relationship as long as they were like hooking up with everyone else in the community at the same time, or
Not
or
that I know.
Having like relation, like no. What was the relationship between the emotion?
That was just, you know, a basic kind of well, that tied in with jealousy was just another kind of social construct. That you wouldn't feel that attachment, that you would feel an attachment to the whole community, but you wouldn't necessarily feel one particular attachment to certain people. That when everything kind of opened up, you would have the same sort of sense of love and connection with everyone in the community. And you wouldn't kind of have your favorites.
So you wouldn't be jealous? Is no, just jealousy like eradicating wrong. Jealousy?
Yeah.
Except for the beautiful
once you have that environment, yeah.
Yeah,
then jealousy is gone.
Because
you don't have monogamy and you're not like seeing people as objects anymore. You don't have control over individuals.
And no one's an asshole anymore, so you're not turned off anymore.
Yeah.
How much do you think he meant that? Seriously, how much was tongue in cheek?
Well, yeah, that's always the big thing, is how it's trying to figure out like how much of it is tongue-in-cheek, how much of it is just him simply saying, okay, here's an extreme example, I know it's an extreme example, but my main point being, and suggesting that, yeah, there's this central character of passion and sexuality that needs to be tapped into, however way it's tapped into. But yeah, so I think there is always a bit of the tongue-in-cheek, but I think also at times he's far more serious than people think. I mean, a lot of people's reaction is, okay, it's got to be tongue-in-cheek, serious. But no, I think a lot of times he was really serious, because he was really, really frustrated by this, and so this kind of what he would consider going halfway wasn't enough. Like, it needed to go all the way and be fully applied. Or it was never going to happen. There was always going to be jealousy, there was going to be domination, there were going to be issues of power and control, and there would end up being limitations, and people would end up happy, so it's going to have to be far more extreme.
To what extent did Fourier's writings influence Wright, if you know?
I don't know. And someone else might be able to answer this better than me.
No idea.
Like, I've never seen and Fourier's a weird thing where it's just, every once in a while, you'll see Fourier dropped in, like, you'll be reading Benny or DeBoer, like, Situationist.
Right.
To mention Fourier, like, Lacan, like, mentioned Fourier in passing. Like, it's very in passing, and Goldman mentions, like, once or twice, I think. But that's kind of it. I mean, he did use a guitar to do it. But it's very in this, you know, just sort of passing thing. But I always, when I first heard about Wright and thought, well, you know, obviously lifted lots of VA, but I've never really seen in what I've read of Wright stuff, direct reference to VA. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much he was involved.
I think I think Wright was laughed at enough that he probably would have been afraid even to like mention Fourier even, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because as soon as he started trying to make a scientific foundation for the things he was saying, everybody dismissed them, and so Fourier would have just made it worse for him probably.
Yeah.
With Oceans of Lemonade and that kind of stuff.
Could you talk a little bit more about your discomfort or like reluctance to talk about M. Goldman's private life in terms of her and how it fit into her political beliefs, just out of curiosity, what your reasons were about that?
I don't know. I think I just kind of got tired of. Well, and often in that weird sort of gendered way, when, you know, she's Emma, she's Emma, she's Emma, and everyone suddenly becomes really relaxed, and then suddenly everyone starts like a lot of focus on her letters, like Chemistals, Love and Anarchy. Just, you know, this voluminous thing of letters between, you know, her and like Ben Reitman, and just that constant focus on her love life, who she was sleeping with, and what she was doing. And the weird thing is, because in a sense, I think there's a lot of value. I mean, especially the way that she negotiated jealousy and relationships, and always struggling with the fact that, you know, on most levels and theoretically, she didn't like monogamy, she hated marriage, she hated jealousy. She thought that you could kind of have meaningful relationships that weren't very sort of linear and fixed and monogamous relationships. But then dealing with the fact, but then fighting like, well, okay, so why do I feel kind of jealous. They're like, why do I feel like I don't want, you know, Bergman to be with anyone else but me? And but like, okay, is that like, what is that? Like, is that inbred somehow? Is that socialization that I'm just fighting against and I just can't get rid of, but once I get rid of it, it'll be okay? Like, is it supposed to be there? Is that telling me something? Is that okay that I feel that? Like, I want to be with only that person and I don't want them to be, however short-term or long-term that situation goes on for. Is that okay that I'm feeling those feelings? Or is that just, okay, that silly, socially constructed crap that it has, you know, no use, and I need to forget it and put it in the back of my mind. So negotiating and dealing with that stuff, I think, is really interesting and really useful.
Well, that text on some other things, too. I don't know if people have read it, but, like, if you look at that text and look at her autobiography, like, her position on, like, homosexuality is really interesting in that her autobiography, in several places, she denies that she ever had sex with a woman, and then in that text, there's a letter from a woman who slept with her describing their sort of like post-coital moment, and like it sort of unearths that like while she was publicly like very pro-queer and very like very much acting in solidarity with all these people, she still had this sort of internalized like shame about it and was covering up this like maybe only one instance, but like this other aspect of like what she was doing herself.
Well, yeah, and the sense to get away from that, because right. So many people, even during her time, were obsessed with this and not taking her seriously. I mean, as a speaker, as an activist, as, you know, as a philosopher. So, I mean, she was constantly fighting against that, and people like Kropotkin were, you know, constantly upset that she was focusing too much on her sex life, sexuality, and these kind of issues. And so, yeah, so I think that was something she always had to deal with, so...
Well, one of the problems, I think, with Lone Anarchy and Emma Goldman is that it's a huge text, and it's always like the elephant in the room when you're trying to talk about Emma Goldman, and it's also a really, really dated text, like bringing it, like you said, there's all kinds of, you know, Freudian overtones in this sort of teleological trying to look at these letters and then go back and reconstruct the psychology of Emma Goldman, what she was talking about, and in some ways it kind of speaks to the fact that there are very few, you know, It's so funny that for, you know, an anarchist movement that's supposed to be about creating this, you know, overture of individual experiences, we're always trying to go back and be like, who are our heroes? And, you know, in doing that, you sort of wind up taking people like Emma Goldman and you wind up with texts like Lone Anarchy and Emma Goldman, which is like, you know, trying so hard to excavate who she was that you wind up, in my opinion, with some really weird and offbeat kind of theories on what she was doing and why she was doing it. But I think in her writing, especially in Living My Life and in her letters, where it's much more clear that than when people sort of try to go back and psychologically excavate what was going on with her. And so I kind of disagree with you that by taking her personal life out, because so with the first writer you're looking at, you're sort of looking at someone who presented this ideal of a sexual community, but then never really got to see it in action, so it was all just theory. And then with someone like Emma Goldman, you have somebody who put together a fairly sophisticated philosophy on marriage and relationships and jealousy, and with her, you have that extra piece of, okay, and I tried it, and here's what my experience was. So it almost gives you much more to work with than a writer who's speaking just in philosophical terms that it's so difficult to suss out what was tongue-in-cheek. And
yeah, no, that's why I say, like, kind of at one point, it depends who I'm speaking with. Like, there's always I'm on a certain level uncomfortable with letters in the sense of, like, say, excavating, like, who she was, in terms more like, in rather not in terms of then making connections of kind of what can we learn from that, or how is that still relevant? Like that, I think is relevant. But I think what becomes is how can we construct this iconic figure, or how can we kind of keep her in history and make this historical figure, and then prop her up and who was she? Like what was she thinking? And then like going back for those more psychological reasons rather than okay, like that's kind of the sense I get from someone when they're going back to her letters. But yeah, but at the same time, and yeah, that's kind of the whole point, is that it's there in politics, like in theory and in practice together. There's, yeah, a lot to learn about.
Since you started off the
the title that you're talking about, Flagging. I'm just curious what, if anything, you guys like think about the idea that maybe anarchism can learn something from kink communities about power is not like this thing that we want to exercise, but like get rid of. It's something that we want to reformulate and like open to like different meanings. So I think a lot of times people are like, you know, get rid of power. And I don't know, I'm just curious what you guys think about that.
I was actually, what I was going to say was related to that. I was going to just pose it maybe as a question to you. I think that, right, it's that the thing that the anarchist community has to learn from gay people on this confusing message, because you touched on like flagging in your paper, but flagging and cruising and gaydar and all that kind of stuff, it's all like the codes are still hidden, right? They're not like out in society. You couldn't just see somebody had a red handkerchief in their left pocket and know what that means like automatically, you know, if you were straight. And I mean, it's down, it's so bad. I mean, there's a bike path where I live where guys are, I mean, having sex all the time at night. And I mean, people still go by on their bikes. And I've overheard people saying, yeah, there's all these guys on the bridge. I mean, these guys are like explicitly fucking and giving each other blowjobs. And I've heard people say like, yeah, there's all these guys on the bridge now. What are they doing there? You know, like, just completely clueless. Like the code is not open at all. It's completely shut down. And so I wonder, you know, I mean, when we're entering this sort of time of a lot of surveillance and that's trying to make sex secret so that it becomes, you know, punishable, right? I mean, because when it becomes revealed, you can punish people for it, right? If you make it so secret. I mean, what is the way, do we open the codes to everybody? Do we let everybody know what the handkerchiefs mean? Or do we, like, just all the people who are having sex right now, do they just have sex in public in front of everybody? Like, I mean, what's the best way to open up the... What do you think?
And I have one thing, sort of a response to that is, it seems like that was obviously what Fourier wanted,
right?
Was to open up the codes, and maybe to some extent, I mean, my question would be, to what extent is that what Emma wanted as well? Did she want to open up the codes, or did she just want everybody to be savvy to them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like everybody should be told so that, you know, I mean, was she really pushing for the same thing?
Maybe, arguably, like in a far less structured, limited way, talking much more generally and abstractly about kind of an ideal social world and everybody being able to, you know, everyone's right to beautiful and radiant things, and just, you know, yeah, taking down the power, but there's still, yeah, like you were saying, I mean, there's still that very limited notion of power is this thing, power isn't a, like, kind of coding a relational thing, it's power is this thing, and you get rid of it, and then all else as well. Does anyone else want to answer that or speak to that? Does anyone else have any ideas about it?
Were you going to speak to that?
My two cents would be like, even before there's going to be a discussion of accessibility to certain codes, I think Ali's point is really well taken. We talked about maybe redistribution of power, that seems to be like a prior question. Why? Because power could be an integral component of desire. And to understand like desires and to understand how a code system would work, well, it'd be helpful maybe just to know how a current power system exists, and then two, what are the possibilities of modifying that and changing it such that desire can be piqued possibly in certain ways, and then possibly issues with access could come a bit later. So I take your point well.
Yeah, because I think that we're talking about power almost in two different ways, and I don't see them as separate. Like, if we talk about Barbara Goldman and her personal relationships and then revolutionary politics as like two different approaches to Emma Goldman, and I think it's, you can't pull them apart. Like, they're. I'm not saying that you did, but I feel like sometimes we want to separate like what we do sexually from what we do politically, and I think that in relationships of non-monogamy where you're trying to get rid of jealousy and this kind of idea that you possess another person and that there is this power dynamic of, or a control thing going on, or there's like, there's a hierarchy or there's patriarchy going on within relationships, then that is just a mirror reflection or a micro relationship that is a reflection of a larger macro relationships of power where men are in control or where there are unequal relationships. And so I think that starting with challenging these relationships of power one-on-one is part of the process of challenging relationships of power that are sort of the big picture, the global picture. Like, I don't think it's a separate project. I think that you have to do both and that they're connected really strongly.
I think that maybe, like, speaking to that a little bit, is like what I heard from what you were saying is like not talking about this getting rid of power in relationships is like recognizing that you do have inequality in your interpersonal relationships, and you do have inequality in societies, and like how do you like take that power and, you know, like mess with it or like own it and work with it because it does exist and you can't. Like, and getting away from this idea of like just getting rid of it and like pushing it out of our lives because it is a real force and it is powerful and it is important, and to recognize it might be a little more functional.
Exactly what you were talking about is like I don't necessarily agree with the premise of what she was saying, but there's an interview with Audre Lorde in one of her shorter text about S&M in lesbian communities and what the political implications of that were. And she was very much opposed to it because she saw it as like this expression of this reinscription of domination and reinscription of all of these attributes of like hierarchical society. Like she wasn't talking about it very explicitly in anarchist terms, but like the sort of critique that she was making was very much a critique of hierarchy and domination and saying like, why the fuck are we doing this in our bedrooms? Like, why is this, you know? And her argument was that a lot of the rationalizations for it and explanations of it that she had heard come out of like the queer scene and from lesbians, she saw as insufficient. And she was saying like, look, like if we're going to critique institutions and society at large on these grounds and critique these elements of domination and exploitation and power and all these other things, then like we have to be critiquing them in our personal lives. We have to be critiquing them in our relationships because we are the subjects of that. Like the subject of revolutions is us. And like it's interesting that like her whole concept of like what was erotic and what the erotic described is really interesting to this discussion, because it's like right down to like Fourier's whole discussion of like the handsome couple. Like one of the points she makes in like the uses of the erotic is that what this narrow definition of the erotic as sexual, as romantic, as these things, it excludes certain people who don't have access to that as frequently or with the same intensity or degree as other people. And so the way to deal with that is not necessarily what Fourier was saying of like making this all public and making this a right, like food or labor or whatever, but was to expand the concept of what the erotic described. And her whole idea was to turn it into something that, or look at it as the creative process and what moved us creatively, so that writing and art and all these other things were expressions of the erotic, and that people could find release and expression and realization of their erotic energy and things like that through a variety of things, and that sex was not at the top of the pile, but that was one of them, and it was an important one, but that there was something erotic about all of these things, which is, I think, a really interesting critique of how we look at those things. I mean, I think it's really highly overlooked in anarchist circles.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of erotic energy in all kinds of activities. We've put together these parties where there's like, I'm kind of the organizer of this kind of naked smoothie party concept where we have smoothies, you know, in the middle of the summer, and then people can also come dressed in whatever outfit they want. And one of the most popular ones recently was a wear anything but clothes party where people were really creative. But at the same time, we also have these sub themes of the party where there's like massage and body painting, and that there's a certain amount of erotic energy there, you know, that isn't like, that doesn't put like what you're saying, sex on the top of the list.
And that's an, oh, I'm sorry.
No,
Okay. You had talked about using sort of the safeguards that the kink communities put in terms just in intimate relationships, where you and I come up with this consensual agreement about how we're going to work together. And those parties that you're just talking about sound like the same thing on a larger scale. So when we talk about, can you use the lessons that you learn in S&M or kink communities to help ensure, you know, consent and respectful relationships on a larger scale, I think you're absolutely right on target, because, you know, it's, you're talking about in like intimate relationships, and then you're bringing it to the next level with, okay, here's a group of people and we use these same sort of consensus agreements within this large group of people. You're sure that if someone walked into your smoothie party and was making other people really uncomfortable, the whole group would sort of come around and say like, hey, this isn't cool, this isn't working. And you can take, you can then move those sorts of,
this
that
is
sort
not
of,
smoothie.
This is not smoothie. You can then move that to the next level of like larger community organizing, where it's not that there aren't codes, but when someone is maybe in violation of those codes, the community decides as a whole how they're going to respond to that.
Yeah, I actually did talk to this one guy who was well known about quickly crossing people's boundaries and making them uncomfortable. I talked to him about it before the party, saying that I was really concerned that he might show up and cross people's boundaries, and we had a really deep conversation about it, and he ended up not coming. That wasn't my intention necessarily, but, you know. It certainly made me feel safer that we didn't show up. But we did have to deal with a lot of consent issues, you know, because last thing you want is, you know, a whole bunch of people, like a group of 10 men showing up to a naked smoothie party and staring at everybody else. And so fortunately we haven't had that problem, because we kind of, we don't really emphasize the nudity as much as kind of the freeing of, the kind of the freeing up of boundaries. You know, a lot of people have said, you know, I was really scared or kind of feeling challenged about coming to this party, but ultimately, you know, I came, and it was a really great experience to free up, you know, these kind of inhibitions that I had in the past.
I just want to take issue with the thing that Audre Lorde said. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying before. I do agree with the idea of an erotics of everyday life, and, you know, understanding and getting... I mean, I think that her idea of S&M being not allowed is sort of misguided.
Oh, yeah, I disagree with that entirely. I was saying I didn't agree with the premise of it, but
right.
Like, I understood where she was coming from on it, and that I think there was another way of critiquing that that didn't rule it out.
Right, okay, and because those sorts of relationships are sometimes the best ways to expose that power is just like a ridiculous role, right? I mean, if you've seen S&M, I mean, I know people who are in S&M that are like, you know, middle school teachers, and they have slings in their basement, and I mean, it's for them, it just completely exposes everything.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. I disagree with the fact that she was opposed
end,
to
it,
but the point that she was making about that we are the subjects of this critique, that like when we're critiquing society or critiquing these institutions, that if we're seeking out, and I think there's a way to seek out hierarchy and domination and things like that, even in, you know, like, say, any sort of kink community or anything, without abolishing particular or you know, excluding or shaming particular things. I think there's ways of picking out and unpacking domination without, like, you know, shaming particular people or creating shame space or anything like that. That's where I diverge from what she was saying. But
it's interesting that she wouldn't make that leap herself.
I know, I've never been able to get my mind around it, but I think it was just there. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
One thing I was really struck by, getting back to Fourier for a second, is that the way the flank is described, some of the features of it, particularly the whole thing about bread being this, like, it's like a topsy-turvy world where bread is a luxury good and sweets are staples. There's like a really close connection between that and American sort of fantasy utopias, like the Big Rock Candy Mountain and things like that, which go back to literature that was written about America to get people to come here. You know, you will find streams that flow with whiskey, and you will find, you know, all these different things. And those found their way into popular songs and popular myths and so forth in popular culture in the 19th century. And that Fourier seems to really tap like directly into that in some uncanny way, like not being an American. And that maybe there's a connection between that. I mean, it seems like Yeah, it was like the world of topsy-turvy. It was like, in both cases, it's like, let's turn everything on its head. You know, sexuality isn't hidden, it's what's on top. And that there's kind of an underground version of that in America as well, that predated Fourier, that he tapped into or fed into. And that maybe what we're getting at a little bit with bringing up this is that there's something highly sexualized about that tradition. That, you know, that's the element of topsy-turvy that's maybe most important, is bringing these kind of physical things to the top and making them what, you know, kind of regulate society or energizes it, instead of having it being something underneath. It's just a thought.
So I think we're done, so we can end on a laughing note.